Support for OPB comes from our members and from our sponsors, like Tracy Ray from the employment law firm of Baron Liebman. Tracy says that OPB sponsorship is a great way to support the community and connect with Baron Liebman's clients.
This is Think Out Loud on OPB. I'm Dave Miller. We are coming to you today in front of an audience at Woodburn High School in conversation with the award-winning writer Edwige Danticat. Edwige Danticat is a novelist, a short story writer, an essayist, a memoirist, although, as with the themes of her work, the borders of those genres are blurry and often overlapping. She writes about the universalities of the immigrant experience across cultures and time, as well as the rich, specific details of the Haitian diaspora. Danticat was born and lived in Haiti until she was 12, when she joined her parents in the U.S. She is a recipient of a MacArthur Fellowship and two National Book Critics Circle Awards. Her latest book is the story collection, Everything Inside. Edwige Danticat, it's an honor to have you on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
You have said that you can partly trace your interest in being a writer and a written storyteller to hearing stories when you were growing up, the oral storytelling tradition in Haiti. What kinds of stories would you hear?
Oh, wow. So many stories. And part of it was, I think, growing up in an era where we had a television in my house in Haiti. My uncle had a television, but it was only for a special occasion. And so storytelling was a means of entertainment. And often it would happen at night, and sometimes when we went to spend summers in the countryside, also at night. But so the stories would be kind of like the folk tales. You know, there was often it would be about a child whose mother had died, right? And there's one about a magic orange tree that I think has some parallel in a story that I've heard here, like the giant in the beanstalk. But this one, it was a girl whose mother had died. She went by the river. She had this seed, and she would sing to the seed to grow. It would be like, "Tis orange grandi, 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 tis orange grandi." Belle mère pas maman, like stepmother's not real mother because the stepmother was treating her badly.
So that's like a kind of universal,
yes,
of bad stepmothers in kids' stories.
Yes, exactly. And I think, and then at some point someone had said, oh, it's because often you have a high infant, you know, maternal mortality rate, you know, like when you get into the real world. But stories like that, stories often about lost children. And there was one story about a horse named Galipot, who is a three-legged horse that came at night for sort of terrible children, terribly behaved children. And then at some point during the U.S. occupation of Haiti, 1915 to 1934, people merged that with the sound of Marines' boots outside their doors. And there was a Tonton Macoud, who was also a character with a knapsack, who put naughty children in there, and during the dictatorship, they became a militia. But, you know, the dictator made them a militia. So there are also the ways that the storytelling would somehow weave itself into history somehow.
Do you see yourself tendrils of that in the work you do now? Do you see connections between the stories you heard and the stories you're telling now?
Oh, absolutely. I think the stories made me a writer. Like when people ask who were your biggest writing teachers, I say, you know, my grandmother and my aunt, because the way they told the story was so much, so instructive to me about storytelling, about engaging other people. I was a very super shy girl, and I would just watch and soak it in. Like there were other kids who were watching and waiting for their turn to retell a story or tell a story.
But it was intergenerational like that.
Yes. It was actually one of the few extraordinarily intergenerational activities, because you were supposed to not even look adults in the eye. Like you were supposed to be so respectful and deferential. And adults, like especially your grandparents, were always supposed to be super scoldy. But this was a moment where you saw them, you know, just really happy. And they were really engaged in the pleasure that the children, the young people were getting from the story, so that if you were sleeping, they would add the song, or they would add some suspenseful element, and they would ask, it was a call and response, creak, you know, the storyteller would say creak, the audience would say crack, tim tim, the storyteller would say boishesh, the audience would say. So there was such an interaction to it that you were not just being told a story, it's like you were given a story, as Toni Morrison writes, to pass on. You know, it was like, now it was your story to pass on.
Your dad left Haiti for the U.S., for New York, when you were 2. Your mom left 2 years later, when you were 4. And then, if I'm not mistaken, besides one trip a couple years later, you didn't see them until you went 8 years after that. So you were raised for that period by your uncle and your aunt. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us a little bit about your uncle?
Yeah, so my uncle was a minister in a neighborhood in Haiti called Bel Air, and that was the neighborhood where they moved to from the people who have migration stories, you often have several layers of the migration. So my family had migration from the countryside to a place called Beau Séjour. It's a good stay in Léogane in the mountains, and they moved to the city, to Bel Air. And my uncle was a minister, and his house was the house of the children whose parents had migrated. So I was in the house with my cousins, and one particular cousin whose dad was in New York and whose mom was in Canada, and other cousins would come through as their parents went to the Dominican Republic and other places. So my uncle was in charge of a household of small children with my aunt Denise, and then a couple of years ago, when there was trouble in the neighborhood in Bel Air, he left Haiti. He had a visa. He'd been coming back and forth to the U.S., then was detained by immigration and died in immigration custody at 81 years old.
It wasn't uncommon, I mean, as you were just saying, for kids' parents to leave Haiti, to go to the U.S. or Canada or France or wherever. Was it assumed that you and those other kids whose parents had gone for work in other places, was it assumed that you would join them at some point?
Mm-hmm. That was always the hope. It wasn't uncommon at all, and it still remains not uncommon, the separation of families, and it's something that sometimes people misunderstand. But I think my parents, as they explained to me later, and as a parent now myself, you know, imagining myself in that position, the parents often have to make this decision: do I stay with my child? And then we both have, you know, we were both in the ways of gangs, we're both in the ways of this dictatorship in our case, in the ways of poverty, or do I make this temporary sacrifice and separate and then reunite with them later? Because often the parents are anticipating you're going to a new country, you won't have childcare even, right? So it was always the hope that once my parents were undocumented, they didn't have papers, they came on tourist visas and they stayed longer, and then they were hoping to change their status at some point, which they did, and then were able to send for us about 8 years later. Once they had got their papers, then they went back to Haiti, because at that time you had to travel to the host country, and that's the one time my brother and I, who were in Port-au-Prince, saw them that one time, and then they returned to the U.S. and our paperwork started, and I was able to join them when I was 12 years old.
Before that, what was it like to live in a kind of limbo where I imagine there was an indefinite expiration date on your time there, but yet that was the only home you knew?
Yeah, I mean, it was, I mean, I see when I go back to Haiti now and I see kids who are in that same situation, and folks call them diaspora, you know, diaspora, like as though they had already left, which is what diaspora is, what you call folks who are, who are Haitian but are living outside of the country.
Like there's a part of them that's not even there, even though they're fully there.
Yeah, so people would say, oh, you know, that one is a diaspora just like you because both their parents are abroad and they're waiting, like, for their paperwork to come through. So there was always a very a limbo. And my brother, who is younger than me, dealt with it in the sense that he was like, you know, it's okay if I don't do so well in school because I'm going, you know. I mean, there was a part of you that was always kind of living in the future. And even my uncle would say to us, you know, sometimes he would say, your parents will fix you when you get to New York. You know, it was like there was that part of your life that was always projected.
Fix you. I mean, was that a threat though?
It was like, you'll get it. Like if you don't behave, I will tell your parents and then there will
be a spanking on the other side of the other country.
Like, you'll get a spanking in about 3 years, maybe.
Let's take a question from our audience. Go ahead. Tell us your name if you don't mind.
My name is Belen Mendoza. And so personally, my parents aren't really fond of the idea of me pursuing a career as a writer. And they kind of want me to pursue a more conventional career, such as like being a doctor or a lawyer, especially as a person of color. So I guess my question is like, what advice do you have for me or others in the similar situation?
Yeah, thank you for that question. First of all, I want to say it's so nice to be here with all of you at Woodburn Senior High School. Thank you for being part of the audience. So my parents were not thrilled at all with the idea of me being a writer at all. Because for one, the first thing was that we grew up under a dictatorship and writers were often persecuted, writers were exiled. Actually, there's our sort of one great, one of many wonderful writers, Jacques-Stéphane Alexis, was ambushed and killed during their lifetime, you know. And so when I would say I wanted to be a writer, that was the first thing that came to their mind. But also they were like, how are you going to make a living? You know, and one thing about being a child of immigrants is that slowly you realize as your life goes along that so much was sacrificed for you to be here, for you to have these opportunities. So my parents were like, you know, try to find a sure career path. And for my parents, that was medicine. And they wanted me to be a doctor. And I said, well, it's a long, and then my dad was like, you can be a nurse. And I'll tell you, to the extent, it was so important to them that when my first book was in Oprah's book club, and I had met Oprah, I was like, you know, and the book was, you know, people were reading the book. My dad still said, like, now you will have enough money for medical school. You know, so that he sort of never let go of that dream. But one thing I would say, you know, you have now at my age and having, you know, teenage children, I can understand both sides of it. And yes, it's very important to follow your dream and to pursue it, which I did, sometimes against my family's wishes. But I think it's also important to have like a backup, like something that you can also pursue while you're pursuing your passion. It may not be medicine, it may be something else, but I think it's also good to have a little footing.
Can I ask you what makes you want to be a writer?
So like for me, I love poetry, and I've realized that like poetry is like a way for me to express myself and feel like safe while doing it and not necessarily having to like speak with someone about it. So that's why I've really like thought about pursuing being a writer.
Thanks for being the first one to ask a question here, too. I'm going to encourage all of you to raise your hands as we go, and we'll get to as many questions as we can. I should also remind folks listening at home that if you're just tuning in, we're talking right now with the writer Edwige Dantica. We are coming to you in front of an audience at Woodburn High School. So, Edwige, let's zoom forward to when you did arrive in the U.S. You were 12 years old. I have heard that you didn't really speak any English when you arrived. What were the first few months of school like?
Yeah, when I arrived, I had my recent, I guess, anniversary. I arrived in March of 1981. It was a Friday. I remember it so well. And then I remember my parents having a conversation that Sunday about whether my brother and I should sit out the school year or go to school. And then my dad was like, no, they go to school. So I arrived Friday. I was in middle school now, but junior high school on Monday. I didn't speak any English, but at that time they had English as a second language classes. So I was in an English as a second language class where it was my one teacher who was in exile from Haiti, from the dictatorship, Mr. Raymond Dussek, who taught every class. So we were it was kind of like, now I've learned like sort of being in first grade or you have the one teacher or kindergarten. Like, so he taught us everything and he was obsessed with soccer. So, and it was the World Cup. It was some big soccer tournament and he taught us everything according to the games. Like we had a TV in the classroom. It was like, this is physics, the way the ball is going. This is science and listen to what they're saying. So he was a really, amazing and fun influence. But
do you remember when you, before you got into that class, that very first day, that Monday morning, did you know you'd have a Haitian teacher or did you have any idea what was ahead of you?
I didn't know anything about the school system in the U.S. or the, you know, in Haiti, it's school, you have these milestone tests, you know, like at a certain age, you take the to go from elementary to secondary, you take a certificat, which is, you know, like a national exam. I had taken that early. So I didn't know how it worked at all. So it was just really walking into a huge school, kind of like this school. And my school in Haiti was pretty small. It was a small building. So it was like all these students, everybody at the same time. It was super overwhelming. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I've read that one of the first books in English that you read was Maya Angelou's I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. Mm-hmm. What did that book mean to you?
Yes. Yeah, so when I got to, you know, not far from where I was going to school was the Brooklyn Public Library. And they would take us on, you know, one of the parts of the thing was going there and getting your library card. And when I went to get my library card, I looked, of course, for like the books in French, the Haitian books that I could read. I got a bunch of them. And then when we got to sort of the English section, I saw this book. It was a paperback with a little girl in a sort of a house. That looked sort of familiar to me. That looks like, oh, this could be in Haiti, but it was in the southern United States. And I remember picking up that book and I read it with a dictionary because I really, really wanted to read it. And I was so blown away by it and with the similarities in our stories and that she was raised, her mom sent her to the South to be raised by her grandmother in a way that felt very similar to how I was raised, like very strict, very, and so reading that book, I felt like gave me permission to write my books because it was so, along with the Haitian books that I was reading that were sort of about my home, seeing my home in a different way. But the stuff she talked about, you know, all the, you know, the really deeply personal experiences of abuse, of, you know, reconciliation with her parents and those years of separation and the way she worshiped her grandmother was the way I worshiped my uncle and my aunt, you know, and then having to leave them at some point. So for me, it proved in a way that the way that literature, you know, I think many people have said, it's been said so much that literature can both be a window and a mirror. You know, you could see a bit of yourself and you can also read to escape. And I felt like that book proved both to me that there were other ways to tell stories, that there were people out there. Like you can write something and someone reads it who you've never met, you'll never meet, but that work can mean so much to them. Hmm.
Do you read books now that hit you as hard as that hit you? Can you recapture that, or was that kind of a cataclysmic time?
I still read books like that. Don't ask me to name any, but I still do. And it's over the years, you know, I remember also reading, you know, the Joyla Club, which was very different from my experience, you know, the Amy Tan and feeling like, whoa, this, like my, those are my, like my aunts, or reading Paul Marshall and others. And there are certainly reading in a way, sometimes it's the least place you expect it. And then it just blows you away. I call it a shock of recognition. Like sometimes when you're reading a book and you're like, this is exactly what I was thinking, but this person said it in that way, like that I could never say it that way. That happens to me all the time.
So that's the reading side. But then obviously you started writing, and you started writing, if I'm not mistaken, for a high school newspaper in New York City that was distributed to a bunch of schools all around the city called New Youth Connections. What made you say, I'm going to do this?
Yeah, it was that journey towards moving away from what my parents wanted me to be, and then actually to try to explore in concrete ways, like how I could pursue my dream, right? So, and it wasn't that easy to write for that a paper, because at that point, if you all can believe it, there was no internet, you know, like I couldn't do it at home and email it. I literally had to get on the subway, which was horrifying to my parents and a little scary for me, go to an office that they had in Lower Manhattan and sit there and type my story, and then the editor would go over it. And that was the process. And then we had to do that a couple of times a week after school. But I really wanted to see how my dream would exist in the real world. And I think that's sometimes something that I think is hard for young people to process, because like sometimes we want to do something, like you want to be a doctor. And even the school where I went to, like my parents put me, I went to a high school, this is how much my family wanted me to be in medicine. My high school was called Clara Barton High School for the Health Professions. So I was commuting from Clara Barton High School for the Health Professions to this publication a couple of times a week. At the same time, my school, we had to volunteer in hospitals. So I was actually, the other time after school, I was volunteering in the geriatric ward at Kings County Hospital in Brooklyn, and both in an effort to kind of see like, what to kind of bring into the present these future visions of my life, to see which I was more sort of like would be able to live with.
Do you remember the day or the week when your first piece came out and people all around the city, but also I imagine your classmates could read your words?
Yeah, I remember it very clearly, because at that point, my younger brother was also in my high school, and I had been there like a good 2 years before him, and I was Andre's sister. and so I was still super shy. And then people were like, oh my gosh, I didn't know, you know, then, kids would read it, the teachers read it, and I had a byline. And so I think people suddenly started seeing me in a different way, and it actually taught me a lot about writing, about the power of words, in the sense that they were amazed, because I was very quiet. I didn't really speak to many people. I didn't have that many friends, and I was in a sort of a program with maybe 30 kids who were on the same path, and I wasn't popular. So when people read it, it was almost like as if they could have this silent conversation with me, like, and I was always blown away by the interactions that provoked, because it was as if we had been talking, and then they were now could respond to what I had said, and that felt so incredibly strange but gratifying to me. And then I realized, oh, this is another way of communicating with people, and to a really large group of people at once.
That's so fascinating to imagine, because what you've just described is the experience that I think so many of us have when we read anything, especially if it's something that moves us. It does feel like we're in conversation with the author or with their characters or with the story but I guess I hadn't thought about it from the perspective of the author, who then experiences people coming up to them as if they actually have been in conversation. That does sound like it would be an odd experience.
Yeah. I mean, it's awesome too, because you're like mid-conversation when you, and I remember when I published my memoir, Brother, I'm Dying, which is in part about my uncle and his story in immigration, but my whole family story is in there, you know, to get to his. And I remember meeting people and they would say, how's Bob? And I was like, you know Bob? They're like, from your book. So that was always, it was both kind of a little eerie and awesome at the same time.
Let's take another question from our audience. Go ahead, please.
Oh, hello. My name is Alondra. I was just wondering, if you could say something to the high school you right now, or the old high school you, what would it be?
Oh, that's such a great question, because I often feel like I'm speaking to the high school me when I'm speaking to my daughters who are in high school. and they always remind me that it's not your time, you know, as young people want to. I would say if you're having a hard time, it gets better, and you don't have to be, like, you won't have to be for the rest of your life the person you are now in high school. And that goes to the ways that sometimes we pigeonhole ourselves or others pigeonhole us. I think it's also very important to learn to enjoy your own company. Like, solitude or being alone is not, it's not going to kill you. I feel like that's the most important thing, to learn to enjoy your own company, so that you're like not at the mercy of other people's love or hate for you, which can change so quickly. Read as much as you can, try to expose yourself to as many experiences in terms of sort of like things that you're thinking you might want to do. Like, I'm very grateful, for example, that I was told to like go volunteer in the geriatric ward or try this newspaper, because there are things that you're looking at now that you're thinking about doing that you never know what will be like. Like would carry you forward into your future. So this paper, my first novel, started up for the last essay I wrote for them. And then when I was done, I thought, oh, maybe I can write more about this. And that became my novel, Breath Eyes Memory, which was the one that was on Oprah's book club. So sometimes there is a thread to things that you're doing now to your future. But stay open, explore, learn as much as you can.
We got to take a quick break, but we have much more with Edwige Dantica and our audience here at Woodburn High School. Stay tuned. This is Think Out Loud on OPB. I'm Dave Miller. We are talking today in front of an audience at Woodburn High School. We're talking with the author Edwige Dantica. She is the author of many books, including Breath, Eyes, Memory, The Farming of Bones, The Dewbreaker, and most recently, the story collection, Everything Inside. Let's take another question from our audience.
Hi, my name is Esperanza Hernandez, and my question is, a lot of your stories deal with a lot of trauma and in general pain. How do you deal with writing this?
Thank you for that question. So I often feel like when I'm, the writing of the story is helping me with the trauma. Writing for me is, of course, you know, a way that I learn what I'm thinking, or what I develop my thoughts. It's pleasure, but also it's therapeutic in many ways. So I feel like when I put my thoughts down, when I put the stories down, I feel a little bit lighter. And also with the hope that other people who are going through similar things might find a little bit of themselves in it. So part of dealing with trauma is writing, but of course, do other things like, you know, exercise and meditate and other things that also helps when you step away from that, the writing, so that the writing is not also re-traumatizing.
Let's go to another question. Go ahead, please.
Hi, my name is Jada. How did you get your first book published?
Thank you, Jada. So my story of my getting my first book published was a little bit unusual. So as I said, I had written an essay for this new, you know, this high school paper, and I aged out, so I couldn't write for them anymore. And I thought, oh, maybe I can write this as fiction. And so I started writing, and I entered the 17 magazine fiction contest, which a lot of writers have entered and some have won, but I didn't win. But then I thought, I got an honorable mention and that encouraged me. And then I sent it to a publisher in New York. It was a small publisher called Soho Press. And later my editors told me that she was trying to figure out, my name was, you know, Edwige, like is unusual. She couldn't tell if I was, she should address my letter of rejection to Ms. Dantica or Mr. Dantica. So she started reading it to figure out. And then she said, oh, and then reading it, she liked it.
Wait, she was going to just say no?
Yes.
Wow. And, just even without having read it.
Yeah, huh?
Even without having read your story, yeah, she was just prepared to say no.
Unsolicited, and I was like a kid. And then she said, oh, so you have more. And I didn't have more. So I spent like months frantically writing more. And then she rejected it. But then she said, when it's ready, you can send it back. And so then I, with that encouragement, I went into an MFA program at Brown University. I made it my thesis and then I sent it back. And then she accepted it before I graduated. So that was like a very unusual kind of journey. But I think people who want to, if you have a manuscript you want to publish, usually there are some publishing houses, fewer now, that will accept unsolicited. They had, you know, my publisher had listed that they do unsolicited, but, you know, not a lot. And some people get an agent, but it's still, there's a lot of information out there now on how to submit and stuff, but it was kind of my story was a bit unusual.
It also seems like at two different moments, no's that came your way, but that left the door open, or that they provided enough encouragement to keep you going, even if it wasn't a yes at that moment. It was keep trying.
Mm-hmm. And publishing often works like that. Like they'll say you sort of like their degrees of rejection. They'll be like, we can't use this, but if you have other things, send it again. And I think if you do submit and that happens, it's good to follow through.
Let's take another question. Go ahead.
Hello, my name is Alondra, and I had a question. You have gone through a lot, and you have shown it in your books, but I was wondering, what are some things that have kept you moving, kept you waking up every morning and dealing with life and everything you have gone through?
What's kept me moving is truly like the stories of people who've come before me, like at any moment that we're living through, and some of, you know, we've lived through a lot in the past two years, the past decade really. And in terms, I think of people like my grandparents and what they went through and how they overcame, like my ancestors and all the people who came before me. But also I think one way to keep moving also is to do whatever service you can, right? And to, there are always people around who need you, you know, whether you think, like when you think you're going through something, you know, extraordinarily difficult, there are always others you can help. So, for example, when the issue with my uncle, when my uncle died in immigration custody, through that whole period, I had been visited detention centers where kids who were separated from their parents were held. I had gone to Congress, you know, to talk about this experience before. I had visited detention places with Congress people and reporters. But so in a way, I felt like this was not just, I knew that this was not just happening to me. So in a way, service is a good way, I think, of moving through the world, and, you know, so like having other people to go on this kind of difficult journey with.
You've written about a particular kind of service that you took part in with your father after your family was reunited in the States. He would take you with him on, I think it was weekly visits to the Immigration Detention Center in Brooklyn, where Haitian refugees or asylum seekers were essentially behind bars. What was he doing there, and why did he bring you?
Well, my dad was a deacon in this church in Brooklyn that in the in the 80s, the dictatorship was just on its way out, and I think it was Rudy Giuliani who was like attorney general, and people were detained in the Brooklyn Navy Yard in New York. And so the church, when people were released, would host them. And my dad was a deacon there. So we would go on Sundays, members of the church would go on Sundays after church to visit people who were being detained. And my dad would take me with him. And what I remember is seeing people who had come by boat. I had a very difficult journey, and a lot of times their family members didn't know if they had made it, and they would often give us like pieces of paper with numbers, and they would say, call this person and tell them I'm here. And so that was all often extraordinary. It's very moving. And so when they were released, and they were released with families within the church and in a location that the church had. So then you would see, even though I was, I was a teenager, you would see over the years how people would grow, once they were released, they would get jobs, they would start families, and you would see their lives over the years. It was just extraordinary to witness.
That's something that you've continued to do as a witness or as a journalist or as a writer, to go to detention facilities in recent years. Can you give us a sense of what you've seen?
The most recent, it's been harder and harder for lay people. I'm not officially a journalist, and often the ways that I would go in would be with, like, if a congressperson was visiting, you would go with a delegation. And I've worked with an organization in Miami called Americans for Immigrant Justice. So most recently I've seen unaccompanied minors, often young people like you, who's and they might have relatives in the States, but their parents are in another country, and it's hard to, that permission process has not happened. So often you see them, they're teenage, like really bouncy, happy, teenagers who've had, some of them, very traumatic experiences. Often they're concerned about missing school, they miss the food, they miss their families, so it's, and I have teenagers. I used to go actually with my daughter when she was much younger, and just to have conversations with them about their journeys. One of the most heartbreaking things I did, I do remember, was that there was a time when the children were so young, and to have a hearing where they were going before a judge. So this organization, American for Immigrant Justice, had to make a coloring book to say to their children, this is the judge, this is the lawyer, and there were very young children who would have to have these hearings, really, and that was the only way that this organization could figure out how to help them tell their stories at their immigration hearing.
How do visits like that, witnessing places like that, how does that make its way into your fiction?
Well, I mean, it's something that I think is so, I feel like it's out of view for most people who don't have a family member in an immigration, in the immigration system. And most immigrant families are mixed status families. So you might have American citizens, people on TPS, people on DACA, people, TPS, Temporary Protected Status, DACA is the program for young people who came here early, young. And so you have this whole range of experiences. So for me, I think fiction is a way that you can flesh out. Like you could present a family and tell a story, tell many different stories that sort of meld just like true stories at the same time. And you can tell true stories while you take some liberties with the intimacies of the lives, and at the same time you protect people. So, for example, I have a picture book called My Mama's Nightingale, which is a fictional version of it's about a child who's trying to get her mom out of immigration custody. And so that was inspired by sort of many children like that who I've met, whose parents are detained while they're out, trying to have a life, trying to go to school, and while this is and having visits, you know, while this is always in the back of their mind.
Let's take another question. Go ahead, please.
Hi, my name's Michaela, and I was just curious if you've ever had second thoughts or regretted becoming a writer?
Not a single day. I have never had second thoughts or regretted being a writer. It's, and I'm sure, like, people, you've heard this a lot, and it's very true. Like, if you love what you do, you'll never work a day in your life. So what I love most about being a writer is kind of following what starts out as a kind of vague, amorphous thought, you know, something you're like, I'd like to write a story about this, and then seeing it becoming more clear, like the clarity, like the story coming, and then to getting it to the point you want, you know. So people have compared it to like being a sculptor who you get a big stone and you're chipping away until like a version of what you imagine in your head emerges. So I love being a writer. I feel very blessed that I get to do it, and I get to do things like this and also share my work with other people once I leave that sort of like that solitary space of being by myself with the characters and with what I'm writing.
We have another question from our audience. Go ahead.
Hi, my name is Jasmine. When you were writing your first novel, is there like anything you wish you would have done differently?
Oh yeah. So I think writers, you know, notoriously like hate their first novels. Like most of the writers I know are like, oh my gosh, I wish I'd done this differently. Yeah. A couple of years ago, so my first novel was published in 1994. So it's almost like 30 years old. And so a couple of years ago, I had an opportunity to do a 25th anniversary edition. And so I tried to tweak a bunch of things that I wish I couldn't change the whole story. But they're looking at it now, you know, with the lens of time. There are many things I wish I could have done. But at the same time, I think like it was, and that's what I always try to do in my work. I try to write the best thing I can right now. And that goes, you know, whether you're writing an essay in school, like you try to get it the best that you can at the moment. And I felt like too, I mean, for a first novel, it was about a young woman who was very close to my age. So I think it actually has that, the rawness of it, you know, is true to that voice of someone who was that age at the time that I wrote it.
I think we have another audience question in the back. Go ahead, please.
Hi, my name is Madison, and I'm just wondering how you deal with something like writer's block.
How do I deal with writer's block? So I often think of like, if you're like, when I'm blocked, I just realize, oh, maybe the story's not ready, right? And so I'll go on to do other things. So I'll read maybe something along the same vein as what I'm writing to see how that author, you know, got through that. So I'll just put it away for a while and let it ruminate. I think because sometimes it takes like your subconscious will work, like even. Like, I always feel like I'm writing, even if I'm driving, I'm picking up my kids from school, like, that process is still happening. So I don't force it too much, but I also try to do some free writing, and the free writing could be, like, you could wake up in the morning and you'd be like, I can't write because, like, to try to do, you know, 20 minutes or so of just, like, a brain dump and just plow through, but sometimes, I mean, sometimes the story is just not there yet.
It almost seems like the way you've reframed this is you're not talking about writer's block. You're talking about story block. Mm-hmm. It's not, the problem isn't you.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, is that a fair way to put it? The problem is a story?
I think maybe different people would experience it differently. But for me, I try to sort of like, yeah, I try to say like, it's just not, it's kind of like if you're cooking, right? The food is just, it's just not ready. So yeah, I think it's, for me, it's, it feels a little more doable shifting the also allowing the story some time to breathe or some agency in the process.
You have a story called Without Inspection, in the, new latest collection. It takes place in the span, technically, of 6.5 seconds. That's the time it takes. And this does not give anything away because we find this out in the first sentence. The time it takes for a man to fall from a construction site to his death. But the story also encapsulates his whole life as he thinks about what's happened in the past and has his hopes for the future as well. That includes his arrival on a beach in Miami and the woman who he eventually makes a life with who takes him in and who saves his life. What was she doing on the beach?
Mm. Well, she is Darlene, who is the woman who loves and who is loved by the main character Arnold in the story, is on the beach because she came through the beach also. And recently, you know, with events in Haiti, we've had more a reoccurring of these arrivals where people would just, who have come by boat, land on the beach in Key West behind some kind of resort or in Key Biscayne or in different. And it's something that if, you know, living in Miami happens quite a bit. So Darlene, because she lost a loved one on that journey and has made herself a kind of a greeter of people who arrive on the beach. And this is kind of her calling to make that transition easier for people, which of course she can't do for everybody, but on the day that, you know, she does that, she's there and meets Arnold, who is the main character of the story.
What did you want to explore in that story in terms of how families are made or reconstituted?
Well, that is the immigration experience, or a huge part of it that is sometimes under discussed, you know, in the public sphere, is that just as my story began, you know, as an immigrant here with my parents leaving me behind so that my family was, which was never defined in the nuclear way anywhere. For us, family was always an extensive, you know, it was just never mother, father, children. But that the way that my family had to step in back there, and then my family in New York that, you know, that greeted my parents there. And so the way we remake family, that's definitely part of the immigration experience, that you, because you're in a situation where you have to really count on others. You have to count on the kindness of strangers, which in a way, I mean, I think defines the whole way that, which perspective you decide to take on immigration, whether you define the stranger as someone who needs your help or as someone you need to keep out, you know? And so, and often within, you know, that starts too, that is defined within family. So I think Darlene in the story, her understanding of that is cleared now, having been on both sides of this, you know, kind of like I have, of having needed to be received or also now having to receive other people.
You wrote an article for The New Yorker 4 years ago with a headline, "We Must Not Forget Detained Migrant Children." But I have to say that in recent years, coverage of immigration policies and of children in the detention system, I have seen a lot less coverage of that. How do you explain that?
I think because the coverage was, of course, very political, very much politicized, where children have been detained, migrant children, refugee children, children seeking asylum, but have been detained for a very long time and continue to be. That process of reuniting them with their parents is still lags. You know, there are hundreds probably of children now who are in different places waiting for some kind of resolution. Some of them become adults in detention. So there's not much more attention to that. And when I wrote that article, that's what I was a little bit concerned. I was very concerned about that, the fact that there was that heightened moment where, you know, we were talking about it and then it goes back. There's a kind of silence about it without much coverage. But people who work in the trenches of immigration, who are always, you know, who've no matter what the administration are always working with children, know that it's something that continues.
What do you seek in an ending, whether it's a short piece of work, a short fiction, or a longer work? How do you know you've arrived at the end of a piece?
I often don't know, because there are pieces, you know, going back to that question of wanting to change things, there are often pieces that years later I feel like, oh, I would love to tag on a little bit more.
But cut something away.
Yes, exactly. And I cut a lot away actually from that transition from something being published in a magazine to gathering them in a book like I did with Everything Inside. But I know, I think there's a certain sense of peace and closure after wrestling a lot and sort of like taking things in, putting them back, taking things in, then putting them back, and realizing, as I said before, that this is where this is going to end. This is the best it's going to be for now.
Adrij Dantika, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me. And thank you, Woodburn Senior High School.
Yeah. Thank you, everybody in our audience, all the students here who asked questions and who took part. Also, thanks to Olivia Jones Hall from Literary Arts and Charles Sanderson here at the high school who made today's show possible. If you don't want to miss any of our shows, you can listen on the NPR One app, on Apple Podcasts, or wherever you'd like to get your podcasts. Our nightly rebroadcast is at 8 p.m. Thanks very much for tuning in to Think Out Loud on OPB and KLCC. I'm Dave Miller. We'll be back tomorrow.
Think Out Loud is supported by Stephen Jen Oliva, the Rosie Tucker Charitable Trust, Ray and Marilyn Johnson, and the Susan Hammer Fund of the Oregon Community Foundation.
If you tune in to Think Out Loud because you love learning about what's happening in our region, you'll love listening to The Evergreen. This weekly podcast paints an audio portrait of the Pacific Northwest through the stories of the people who live here. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts.